who at this critical moment in a world full of tensions and disunity can doubt the need for unity of purpose and action. Perhaps as never before, the question of war or peace overshadows the deliberations of this General Assembly.
Those words from Dr. Ali Satri Amit Jojo of Indonesia set the somber mood at the opening of today's 16th session of the United Nations General Assembly, the question of war or peace. NBC News presents a special report on the opening of the General Assembly and the problems it faces, United Nations conflict. Now to bring you the report, here is NBC News correspondent Leon Pearson.
First, very briefly, a resume of today's developments at the United Nations. The election of the President of the General Assembly, with amazing smoothness and unanimity, Moon Jae-slim was elected. It had been agreed upon in advance. This, of course, is quite another office from the Secretary General. There followed election of lesser officers, vice presidents, committee chairmen, all this in the morning session running over time. In the afternoon, eulogies for the late Secretary General, Mr. Hammarskjöld. And off limits, that is, beyond the UN building itself, disclosure of the results of the disarmament talks between Ambassadors McCloy for the United States and Zorin for the USSR. Also offstage, the struggle over a successor to Mr. Hammarskjöld. We'll have a special report on this. Late in the day, the newly elected president of the Assembly, Mr. Slim, held a news conference and disclosed that he rejects the Soviet Troika principle. This is very significant. At the same time, he said there should be an immediate solution to the problem of selecting a secretary general. The Russians are stubbornly pushing their plan for a three-headed, self-vetoing secretariat, that is, the Troika. The Soviet position is reported now by Joseph Michaels.
The Soviet attitude toward the secretary generalship, as of this moment, remains unchanged and is basically this. The secretary general, whom they opposed, is gone, and his replacement should be the three-headed monster they have been trying to graft onto the UN structure for the past year. They insist that they will challenge the legality of any interim or secretary general. However, they, like everyone else, are suffering from an apparent confusion caused by an event that nobody's plans anticipated. And so Russian and other communist bloc representatives are more in evidence and more talkative than is usually the case. They are sounding people out about the general feeling and, quite informally, and they insist unofficially, coming up with suggestions. Most of these call for what they call a compromise. The line goes roughly like this. Obviously, nobody is going to get everything they would like to have. The Russians won't get their troika, and the West won't get a secretary generalship with the powers that Mr. Hammarskjöld once held. So they urge, why not compromise? Why not appoint for this session a caretaker or a caretaking committee, which would have only administrative authority? Then the next session might consider a final solution. This, of course, is a variation on the same old theme. It would mean a United Nations, which would, in effect, be without a head. And after such a situation existed for a year, it would be perfectly logical for the Russians to then suggest that since the UN had functioned this way for a year, why not continue in the same fashion? Presumably, Mr. Gromyko, who has spent most of the day seeing important delegates at his Park Avenue headquarters, is purveying much the same line. Years ago, when the American labor movement was afflicted with problems involving communist infiltration, a bluff CIO executive discussing the problem of masquerading infiltrators said that all he knew was when he saw something that had feathers like a duck, waddled like a duck, and quacked like a duck, as far as he was concerned, it was a duck. And the communist proposals being aired in the UN corridors sound very much like the same old duck. Joseph Michaels, NBC News, United Nations.
I encountered Mr. Gromyko in the corridors this afternoon, questioned him about the selection of a new Secretary General. He said very firmly, this is for the Security Council. And when I asked if he would object if the matter were raised in the General Assembly, he said again, this is for the Security Council. Obviously, he will object. It will be a parliamentary battle. Now, for an account of the U.S. position in this matter, here is Pauline Frederick.
The United States stands today where it stood 1 year ago when Soviet Chairman Khrushchev demanded that Dag Hammarskjöld resign. Khrushchev said then the United Nations should be run instead by a committee of three, one representing the NATO bloc, another the Warsaw Alliance, and the third the so-called uncommitted or neutral nations. Each of these officials could veto the other. The United States said then, and it says today, that there can be only one head officer of this world organization, a man who is guided not by political blocks or curbed by vetoes, but whose responsibility is to the organization as a whole and whose mandate is the charter. The United States firmly supported Hammarskjöld in his determination not to yield to the Russian pressure because, as Hammarskjöld said, this would be tossing the organization to the winds. It was anticipated, however, that this crisis would have to be faced in April 1963 when Hammarskjöld's term of office came to an end. Now that the issue must be faced here and now, the United States is determined to continue its fight for an independent Secretary General. This will be difficult, for the Soviet Union will push its paralyzing plan. To transform the Secretary General's office into a committee would require an amendment of the Charter during which procedure of veto could block the scheme. But if the Soviet Union can get sufficient Afro-Asian support for a troika of undersecretaries to curb a Secretary General, the United States may have a difficult time defeating this Soviet-approved alternative. What's ahead for the United Nations as an organization rests largely in the hands of the great powers. If they can reach some ceasefire in their Cold War, there is hope. Tomorrow's private luncheon between Secretary of State Rusk and Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko may provide indications as to whether there are any grounds for such hope. This is Pauline Frederick, NBC News at the United Nations.
While the positions of the East and West seem frozen, the third force, that is, the uncommitted nations, may swing the balance of power. How they feel is reported now by NBC's Catherine Clark.
There is excitement among the Afro-Asian countries at the United Nations. Awareness of their potential political power may make them side against the Soviet Union, while opportunism and personal ambition may create a split within their own ranks. The Afro-Asian countries are declaring themselves in favor of a temporary Secretary General, someone to act as Secretary General while the struggle in the Security Council goes on. Some believe that this acting Secretary General should serve only until the Security Council comes to a conclusion. Others want him to serve the remainder of Hammarskjöld's term, which would mean through 1963. The Russians do not want any temporary chairman at all. The Afro-Asian countries also want this temporary Secretary General to be from their own ranks. U Thant of Burma is the name mentioned openly, but there are other Afro-Asians who would like the job. So we may see Afro-Asians standing up to be counted against mighty Russia and possibly even against each other. Catherine Clark, NBC News, United Nations.
On this general subject, we hear that the Indian delegation, the delegation of India, wants no tampering with the UN Charter in order to find a way to a successor to Mr. Hammarskjöld. The Indian delegation wants a Security Council meeting to try first to solve the deadlock. This, of course, supports, generally speaking, the position being taken by the Soviets. As of this time last evening, there was a move to name Monji Slim not only as Assembly President, but also Secretary General pro tem. Well, that collapsed. Too much for one man. Next proposal, Ambassador Frederick Boland of Ireland, the retiring Assembly President. Well, he shook his head. He was too glad to be free of office for a change. Next proposal, and you've just heard this from Catherine Clark, and this is really taking hold, the ambassador from Burma, U Thant, a former high school principal in his country, then press officer for his government, and head of the Burma radio service. He's a calm, unruffled Oriental, liked by everybody. I suggest you remember the name U Thant. It's spelled U-T-H-A-N-T. Now for a look at the United Nations as it bridges 16 years. Here is Bill Henry.
Way back, while World War II was still in progress, some of us saw the United Nations being brought into this world in its swaddling clothes. First at Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, and then formally at San Francisco. Even though we were startled to learn at Dumbarton that the Soviet had been granted 3 UN memberships to our 1, and despite the fact that they were already making trouble at the San Francisco organizing meeting, there was a great feeling of hope throughout the world. Now, here at New York, with every indication that the Russians will seek to emasculate the UN by replacing the late Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld with a 3-man board whose vetoes could paralyze any action, there is much talk, in fact, grave fear, that the organization's in danger of reaching the end of its rope. While the air today is filled with heartfelt eulogies of the late Dag Hammarskjöld, the fact is that behind the scenes there is utter confusion, either regarding the identity of a successor or the means of getting him into office over the veto-armed opposition of the Russians. There's genuine sadness over the fate of Dag Hammarskjöld, but much of the sorrow here concerns the shape in which the UN finds itself. The feeling is that no matter what develops, the Russians win and the UN loses. This is Bill Henry, NBC News at the United Nations.
But there is a pretty good chance the Russians will be snowed under in this controversy over naming a Secretary General. As of tonight, especially with the disclosure by Monji Slim that he opposes the Soviet Troika idea, there's a pretty good chance that the non-communist proposal for an interim Secretary General elected by the General Assembly will carry. True, the Soviets are technically right, that is, the selection of the SG should be done by the Security Council, but on a temporary basis it might be permitted in the Assembly. Outside the Assembly Hall, there was news about disarmament. With that report, here is Joseph C. Harsh.
In some way, directly or indirectly, everything happening here in the United Nations today affects or will be affected by the great central issue of the times, the clash of will between Russia and America over Berlin, the Berlin crisis. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, Russia's Andrei Gromyko will go to the Waldorf Tower to lunch with our Secretary of State, Dean Rusk. No one expects seriously that this first meeting at high level between Russia and America since the Berlin crisis broke will settle anything or disclose even the outlines of a possible settlement. At a second or third meeting, if they take place, some light might begin to show. But today, with so much riding upon tomorrow's opening encounter, men of hope seized upon a small incident here as being a good omen. The Russians agreed to join us in filing with the United Nations a report on 3 months of disarmament negotiations between their Valerian Zorin and our John McCloy. In it are 6 points of agreement in principle, most of it old stuff long since hammered out in previous rounds of disarmament talks, but one new concession by the Russians. They agreed for the first time that if we ever do start down the road to disarmament, we're to move by stages, each stage to be completed, inspected, and verified before starting upon the next stage. Previously, the Russians always insisted on taking disarmament right through from beginning to end, no pause for verification along the way. Members of the American delegation put a happy gloss upon this, called it significant, that in spite of the ominous rumblings over Berlin, there can be an agreed report by America and Russia, that it contains 6 points of agreement in principle, and that one is a new concession by Russia. Against this must be set Russia's bomb number 14 set off today, and that the disarmament negotiators fail to agree on how disarmament talks are to begin again. The Russians insisted on building the Troika into the next talks. We refused. This puts Russia's one new concession on the far side of the Troika, makes it meaningless unless the Troika is first pulled from the road. Yet 24 hours before the Rusk-Gromyko talks open, there was the one Russian concession here, small, perhaps meaningless, yet encouraging to those looking for some glimmer of light in the surrounding gloom. There are overtones of goad and carrot technique here, the goad of the bomb blast, the tiny carrot of the small disarmament agreement. Add that Belgium's Paul-Henri Spaak is said from Moscow today to be encouraged by his talks there with Nikita Khrushchev. At least Mr. Rusk can wait for his caller tomorrow with some slight evidence that the caller's big boss back in Moscow has chosen to show the tip of an olive branch between his bomb rattles. This is Joseph C. Harsh, NBC News at the United Nations.
While the power blocks gird for battle at the United Nations, the problem for which Dag Hammarskjöld gave his life has apparently been solved, at least in a preliminary stage. This report now from George Clay in Indola, Northern Rhodesia.
The Katanga conflict is over for the moment. President Chombe and United Nations officials have negotiated the very ceasefire which Dag Hammarskjöld was flying to Indola to effect. The ceasefire will come into effect at a minute past midnight. Both sides will withdraw to the positions they occupied before the fighting began. Prisoners will be exchanged, and a four-man commission, two from Katanga and two from UN, will work out the armistice details. But this threatens to be a brittle peace. Announcing the ceasefire to newsmen in Indola, Chombe was bitter and uncompromising about what he termed United Nations aggression. He claimed that 1,000 people had died and Katanga had suffered $50 million worth of damage as a result of the UN action. This is almost certainly an overestimate. United Nations officials said the UN forces had sustained only 8 dead and 42 wounded. And as they have been outnumbered on nearly all occasions, it seems unlikely that they in turn could have killed so many Katangese. But there could be no overrating Chombe's genuine anger and sense of grievance, a grievance that has been backed by the blood of many Katangans.
Even though many observers have long expressed doubt about the completeness of Chumbi's hold over Katanga. As of now, the outcome of the Katanga peace talks seems a hands-down win for Chumbi. The UN negotiators obviously went out of their way to placate the Katanga president. Before the news conference, newsmen were specifically urged not to ask provocative questions, which might, as a spokesman put it, touch up a major incident. This certainly does not suggest the climate for a lasting agreement. It leaves unsettled the root question of Katanga's future status in the Congo. And as if to underline the uncertain basis of the fact, UN officials were careful to emphasize after Mr. Chumbi had his say that the agreement was only provisional and would have to be ratified by the UN. Everything points to a very uneasy peace in Katanga. George Clay, NBC News, Ndola.
As we pointed out a moment ago, the first order of business today at the UN was the election of Monji Slim of Tunisia as President of the General Assembly. Here, speaking through the voice of an interpreter, are excerpts of Ambassador Slim's remarks as he took office.
It is still laboring under the effects of an understandable shock caused by the sudden and tragic death of the Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, that I shoulder the heavy responsibilities to which your confidence has called me. You can therefore guess the feelings that invade me as you confer on me the honor of being elected to the high post of President of the 16th session of the General Assembly. It is hard for me to express the great grief I experience as I take my place next to the chair that before these days and for 7 years was occupied by the late Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld. The Secretary General of the United Nations fell a victim to his duty. He, so to say, died on the battlefield of peace.
Monji Slim is a short, round man with a deep mustache, thinning hair. He turned 53 only last Friday. He is the first African to be elected Assembly President, but he is quite unlike the Africans from Ghana or Nigeria, being very light in complexion, a North African Muslim. His reputation rests principally on his being an in-between man, so to speak, just as he comes from a country, Tunisia, on the Mediterranean, which lies between dark Africa and Europe, and between Asia and the West. He displays the faculty of standing reasonably between the various voices and contentions. After President Slim's eulogy of Mr. Hammarskjöld, a succession of delegates from various parts of the world added their own expressions of praise and sorrow. Of the many addresses, the remarks of Ambassador Adlai Stevenson stirred the delegates deeply.
I doubt if any living man has done more to further the search for a world in which men solve their problems by peaceful means and not by force than this gallant friend of all of us. Indeed, he gave his life in a mission of peace, a mission to persuade men to lay down their arms that reason might prevail over force. That his mission was fulfilled this afternoon by a ceasefire agreement in Katanga is a fitting epitaph for this soldier of peace. Dag Hammarskjöld once said, at a moment of crisis in his life and in the life of this organization, that the man does not count, the institution does. Yet institutions are made to serve men, and it is from the greatest men that they derive their character and their strength. The memory of this one man, humane, cultured, judicious, possessed of a poetic and philosophic vision, free of passion other than a passion for the rule of reason and of decency, modest and brave, this memory will always be with us as a reminder of the best that the United Nations can be and of the qualities which it demands of all of us. In closing, let me suggest, Mr. President, that the most fitting tribute the United Nations can pay to Dag Hammarskjöld is that he should be buried here by the river at this headquarters of the organization to which he gave his life.
Mr. Stevenson's inspired proposal probably will not be realized. Sweden has its own plans, as Al Simon reports from Stockholm.
Dag Hammarskjöld, citizen not only of Sweden but of the entire world, is being given full honors by his country with a formal state funeral on Friday, the 29th of September. With the exception of the former king of Sweden, Gustav V, who died in November of 1950, this honor has not been bestowed on a Swedish subject since 1896, when the country honored its Minister of Justice, Louis de Geer. The formal honors to Dag Hammarskjöld will begin with a brief ceremony outside Stockholm when the UN chartered DC-7, bringing him home, touches down at Bromma Airport on Saturday of this week. His body will then be taken to the university town of Uppsala, some 40 miles north of Stockholm, and the place where Dag spent a good part of his boyhood and college days. The casket will lie in the Uppsala Cathedral until the funeral service, which will be conducted on Friday, the 29th of September, by the former Archbishop of Sweden, Erling Edom. According to the wishes of his next of kin, Dag Hammarskjöld will be buried in the family vault in the cathedral churchyard. Among those attending the state funeral will be Sweden's King Gustav Adolf and Queen Louise, as well as representatives from throughout the world, including Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt from the United States. The Swedish people are also showing their respect for Dag Hammarskjöld with church services, student memorial programs, and draped portraits of our dog, as they often called him, in numerous shop windows. At one church service, some $400 was collected, and this marks the beginning of a Dag Hammarskjöld Memorial Fund for helping students from the newly developing nations. This is Al Simon, NBC News, Stockholm.
When news of the ceasefire in Katanga first reached the Assembly Hall this afternoon, I took the news dispatch to various delegates. The reaction was one of great joy. I met the veteran diplomat of Peru, Belaunde, former president of the General Assembly. His eyes gleamed. He said, "This is the monument to Hammarskjöld. In this way, he has achieved in death what he worked to achieve in the last days of his life. If eventually it is successful that there shall be a unification of the Congo, it'll be a great victory not only for the Congolese, but also for the devoted people who work here on the banks of the East River in New York." This is Leon Pearson, NBC News.
This report on the opening of the 16th United Nations General Assembly was produced by NBC News. Producer, Ray Hassan. Director, Keith Donaldson. Hear Attorney General Robert Kennedy meet the press Sunday on NBC.